Summer is usually a great time for food choices for people in Wisconsin. Backyard gardens, farmers markets, grocery stores brimming with fresh produce. But for a lot of people, they don't have those choices because school is not in session. A lot of kids get their nutrition during the school year, so we need your help. St. Vincent de Paul has a food pantry that gives your neighbor in need some of the same choices you have. But to keep it going, we need your help, your donations, support the food pantry. And you can do one of a couple things. Drop off an extra bag of groceries from the store or your local farmer's market. Also, a $50 cash donation feeds a family of five for a week. You can organize a food drive, whatever it takes to keep that food pantry going this summer while the kids are at home. Let's do what we can. Here's what you do. You contact St. Vincent de Paul at svdpmadison.org. That's svdpmadison.org. Let's work on this together.
You have a broken guitar? Don't fret. Take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson to Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We'll have you fretting your guitar in no time at all. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, we love guitars.
Welcome to another podcast at slysoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff with us. Casey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sly.
All right. At least that's when we're recording this. Who knows when people are listening to it. A lot of big stories in the news regarding the legal cases and criminal law. Let's start out in St. Paul, Minnesota.
You thought I'm getting it?
It was the video seen around the world.
Oh, my God. Please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
32-year-old Philando Castile shot five times during a traffic stop for a broken taillight last summer. His girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, streaming the graphic aftermath live on Facebook. Reynolds' then 4-year-old daughter in the back seat.
It's okay, I'm right here with you.
Tonight, the officer, Geronimo Yanez, has been found not guilty of manslaughter. The Castile family is outraged.
My son loved this city, and this city killed my son, and the murderer gets away.
And for that man to get on the stand and lie, for them jurors to not have enough human empathy and a conscience to just do the right thing.
10 white jurors and 2 black jurors deliberated 4 days after Officer Yanez took the stand in his own defense, saying, "I did not want to shoot Mr. Castile. It was not my intention. I was scared to death and I thought I would die." He said Castile, a school cafeteria worker, matched the description of a robbery suspect, that he smelled marijuana and saw Castile reach for a gun.
Told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand open.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license.
Prosecutors argued Castile had a permit, warned the officer he had a firearm, and that the officer overreacted. The shooting last summer sparked weeks of protest and flared racial tensions. Tonight, a heightened police presence as Officer Yanez has been found not guilty.
No comment. No comment.
Even though Yanez has been found not guilty, the city of St. Anthony, Minnesota has decided to remove him from the force, saying tonight the public will be best served if Officer Yanez is no longer a police officer in our city. Lester?
All right. So this is the first time, I believe, in Minnesota's history that an officer has been charged with this serious an offense, and it hinged on whether the officer was in fear for his life. Your thoughts about this case, Counselor?
Well, it's interesting because you have a situation where it was live streamed on Facebook. Now, you don't have video, from my understanding, from the actual time where he was reaching for his license and the officer said he thought that Mr. Castile was reaching for a gun. But what you do have is you have information in this case, which is why I it's hard to say you're surprised by a verdict because juries can do anything, but just based on the video and based on the other evidence that was really admitted to, including that Mr. Castile warned the officer that he had a valid, concealed carry weapon and he had a valid license for it, and did what we want people in these situations to do, which is to warn officers. The whole point of warning him, presumably, was to make sure that the officer was not afraid and that Mr. Castillo didn't get shot. And so, you know, whenever I have a situation that somebody, you know, somebody is wondering about where they've got a valid concealed carry permit, all the information I've ever heard was to tell the officer about that. So there's no surprise when the officer sees it or when you're being patted down if the person is going to be arrested. But in this case, you had a minor traffic violation, a broken taillight. You have the officer's statement or testimony that he believed that Mr. Castillo had been smoking marijuana at some point, or he smelled marijuana at some point, which I don't understand how that...
Yeah, that doesn't seem germane to anything.
No, it doesn't seem germane to anything. And so then what you're left with is he appeared to match a suspect in some sort of robbery or burglary investigation that's ongoing. But again, if he was going, if Mr. Castillo was going to harm the officer, why would he then tell the officer that he had this, you know, valid concealed carry permit or license to carry a firearm? Why would he say that? I mean, that just, to me, that doesn't pass the smell test. And so, you know, the idea.
Now you're saying this is a criminal defense attorney.
Well, I am, because I think that. Here's my frustration, Sly. I think police officers have a very difficult job to do, and I think they do, most of them do a very noble job. But you have situations like this that really shakes public confidence, I think, because, you know, people are expected to know the law. They're expected to understand the law. We've already had United States Supreme Court cases that hold that officers can have a reasonable mistake of law. In other words, if an officer is pulling somebody over and it turns out that the officer pulled someone over for a traffic violation that wasn't actually a traffic violation, as long as the officer reasonably understands or reasonably thinks it was a traffic violation, that's okay. He can still pull them over and he can still get the evidence in. That doesn't work for a regular citizen. A regular citizen can never come into court and say, you know, I just didn't know that this was against the law. And so when you have a situation like this where I think a lot of citizens are put to a standard, a pretty high standard when it comes to firearms, as they should be, by the way, because firearms are dangerous. I think people look at this and they go, this situation where he had it on video, he had Mr. Castillo who appeared to be, he had just been shot, but it wasn't, you know, there was no indication that he was belligerent. There was no indication that he was angry. His girlfriend was not angry. She was, you know, surprisingly calm. You had the 4-year-old in the back. So, you have a situation where I think people start to think that there's a different standard for regular citizens as opposed to officers, and that's frustrating for people. Now, I get it that officers have a difficult job to do. I get it that you have to look through at this through the eyes of a reasonable police officer in the situation that's encountering danger. But this one, this verdict, I was very surprised by. I mean,
We've had a series of verdicts that have been surprising. The case in Tulsa was surprising, and the case in South Carolina, which, if I'm not mistaken, was a mistrial, that was surprising.
Yeah, the one where the officer shot the guy in the back.
Well, that one appears to be the clearest case of malfeasance from a police officer.
It does, and so I think you have a lot of acquittals. There's no doubt that officers are often acquitted of these charges, and I think juries often think to themselves, you know, police officers are in a difficult spot, and many of them are, and, you know, they're going into situations they have no idea what's going on, and so we should give the benefit of the doubt to them. And jurors are right in the sense that we should give the benefit of every reasonable doubt. We must, under our system, to people that are charged with crimes. But it's just that when you look at this video and you see how calm people were, and you see somebody that was doing, I just don't know what else Mr. Castillo could have done. I really don't.
Should he have asked, is it okay for me to show you my ID?
Well, I suppose, but my understanding was the officer asked for the ID. I could be wrong, but, you know, officers oftentimes ask for somebody, almost every time, they'll ask for your ID.
Right, so, it's one of the first things they do.
Yeah, I mean, your license or registration, that's a standard thing. And so I just don't know what else he was supposed to do. I really don't.
So
I
mean, did Geronimo Yanez have carte blanche, Officer Yanez, have carte blanche to just essentially use this I feared for my life as a get-out-of-jail-free card?
Well, no, that's not the way the law is supposed to work. I mean, you look at it from...
Well, I understand that, but in reality, in looking at what juries do, even mixed-race juries, although 10 to 2 is... But still, this was a mixed-race jury. It appears as though juries do not want to convict police officers.
Well, and that's the tough part, is how do you, you know, what lesson do you come away with from this trial? You and I have talked about before the dangers of doing that, but I think when people look at this particular case, the benefit they have to it is, you know, and video doesn't tell everything, but we have a live stream Facebook video, and we have basically a narration of what happened that evening. And so when people really take a look at this, and I think they think to themselves, this could happen to me. And then, of course, you add on top of that the, you know, potential racial elements of the situation where we have, you know, we do know from lots of different studies that there is, at the very least, an unconscious bias among many people. And that's not just police officers. It's you, me, it's everybody. Most people have some sort of unconscious bias. It doesn't mean that the person is racist, but it does mean that we all go in with our preconceived notions about people. And so when you're dealing with somebody that's black, that issue often comes up, and it's borne out by statistics that show, you know, black people are pulled over more often. You know, we know in our criminal justice system, on average, they're sentenced to more time than white defendants are. And so you add that element to it as well, and it really makes people very, very uncomfortable.
Although we're dealing with really two minority people here. We have a Hispanic officer and an African-American who was the victim of this circumstance. Second-degree involuntary manslaughter. Do you think the district attorney's office in Ramsey County overcharged?
I don't think so, because they also had another charge, which is endangering safety by discharging a firearm. You know, I mean, the second-degree manslaughter charge, I suppose if this were in Wisconsin, for example, you could charge somebody with negligence. A negligent homicide is another potential charge that people are charged with. But I don't see anything wrong with the actual charging decision here. I think you've got a situation, Sly, that you and I've talked about where, you know, the jury, for whatever reason, you know, did not vote to convict. And it may be because we give the benefit of the doubt to police officers. Like I said, we should do that to every defendant, not just police officers. But it's hard to know. I mean, it's like in the Bill Cosby case. You don't know.
We'll get to that in a moment. Let me read a quote here. Earl Gray, the defense attorney for Geronimo Yanez, he said, "The state didn't have a case in the first place," Mr. Gray said in an interview on Friday evening. "Because of the protests and political pressure, I suppose you'd call it that he was charged and he had to go into court and defend himself." Mr. Gray said Officer Yanez was still very shook up about the verdict. So the defense is charging that these were politically motivated charges.
Well, you know, I think they can make that charge, and certainly when Mr. Castile was shot and killed, I remember President Obama making some type of statement about it. And so from that perspective, I guess you can argue this was politicized, but I think both can be true, right? I mean, you can have a situation that people are trying to make broader philosophical and political arguments about racial injustice and things like that. But also you can have a charge that was justified to begin with. And I just don't see a very strong argument that this officer should never have been charged in the first place. I think there are lots of charges that are charging decisions that are made on much weaker evidence than was presented here. And you had video. It wasn't just a he said, she said, or in this case, he said, but Mr. Castile died. It wasn't just that. You had video evidence to back it up. You had a lot of statements you had a lot of things about this case, including the officer's claim that marijuana had something involved with it that I find, frankly, dubious in terms of being more afraid for your life because of that. I just, I think there was clearly enough to charge, but, you know, a jury acquitted him.
And we're going to have a very interesting case as the trial begins in Wisconsin with a black officer and a black suspect in a crime that was shot and killed. And neither of these individuals have sympathetic records considering the other things swirling around this case. But it does show you the hurdle that prosecutors have in getting the jury to convict a police officer.
Absolutely.
We'll talk more with Casey Hoff next at SlysOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
You're at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff with us. Casey, not only the acquittal of Officer Yanez in the St. Paul area in Minnesota, but we also had the Cosby trial going on. Interestingly enough, the deliberation longer than the trial itself. It was a strange trial. Let me play the story of the mistrial coming down.
For Bill Cosby, neither vindication nor victory, said Judge Stephen O'Neill, as he declared a mistrial. The jury deliberated 52 hours, longer than the entire trial. Unable to unanimously agree whether Cosby drugged and sexually assaulted Andrea Constan, a former Temple University women's basketball manager, at his home in 2004. Cosby claimed the encounter was consensual. In a statement, Constan's lawyer saying, "We are confident that these proceedings have given a voice to many victims who felt powerless and silenced." Other women who've accused Cosby of assault vowing to keep fighting for justice.
Only 2% of rapists in this country ever spend one day in jail. It's time for reform, people. Open your eyes.
Afterwards, Cosby remained quiet while a spokeswoman read a statement from his wife, Camille, blasting District Attorney Kevin Steele, who made prosecuting Cosby part of his election campaign.
How do I describe the District Attorney? Heinously and exploitively ambitious. How do I describe the judge? Overtly arrogant and collaborating with the District Attorney.
With no hesitation, Steele said he would put Cosby on trial again.
In all of our minds that this was the right thing to do.
While more than 50 women have publicly accused Cosby of sexual misconduct, allegations he denies, Constan's case is the only one recent enough for criminal charges. Accusers like Jewel Allison, who claims Cosby assaulted her in 1990, were there supporting Constan and hoping Cosby finally would be found guilty.
I thought it was just right there. It's like sitting in class, and the teacher comes and writes it all out on the blackboard, and it said 2 + 2 = 4.
You think eventually a court will convict him of a crime?
He walked out, but the bars were all around him. He's in jail now. I could see it in his face.
It's too early to celebrate, Mr. Cosby. Round two, maybe just around the corner.
And that is Gloria Allred, shockingly, in front of a camera. Isn't that amazing? Never seen her in front of a camera before. Yeah. So first of all, the woman in this case that Mr. Cosby was accused of sexually assaulting, couldn't she have combed her hair or something, or was there some sort of weird electrical surge going on in that courtroom? What was going on there?
I don't know, Sly. Okay. It was interesting.
Yeah, that was... Well, okay, so there were inconsistencies in some of her testimony. This is kind of similar to the case where the Canadian broadcaster Gian Gameshi had been accused of sexually assaulting someone, and the defense effectively tore that witness to pieces, and he was acquitted. What do you make of this Cosby case?
Well, you know what? I'm actually... This one, I'm not surprised at the verdict. And
really?
I'll tell you why. There's a number of reasons for it. Now, we all
know... I've never liked him.
I understand that. Well, but we all know in the public about all of the other allegations, the dozens and dozens and dozens of women that have come out and basically given a very similar story as to what happened. You know, he gave me some pills, he gave me some drugs, and, you know, I passed out, and then he sexually assaulted them. So it's surprising if you took all those into consideration. But remember, the judge did not allow in all of those other allegations, with the exception of one from 1996 that he did allow in. But all of the other allegations were not in evidence. So what the jury was left with was they were left with two different allegations, one, you know, from two different women, but they were not left with the scores and scores of allegations you might think. So from that perspective, it would be surprising, but I think only if they had allowed all those other allegations in, because then you have to show not only were these two women not telling the truth, or at least one, and the other one you could argue the other one that he wasn't actually charged with was telling the truth, but the other person was not. I mean, there's a number of different ways that could be argued. But to disprove all of those, and let's be clear, again, they don't have the burden of proof, and so you don't actually have to disprove, that's probably the wrong word, but to discredit those allegations, all of them would be difficult. They didn't have to do that in this case, and actually I think the judge made the right call. I think judges are far too lenient, generally speaking, in letting in evidence, we call it prior bad acts evidence, that tend to show that somebody has the propensity to commit a crime, even though we're supposed to charge people and convict them only if they've actually, the state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they've committed this crime. We're not supposed to just liberally allow all types of other evidence to come in, especially in sexual assault cases.
Okay, but in this case, wasn't there a civil trial with a deposition where he essentially admitted to drugging women?
Well, okay, but here, yes, but here's the thing about that. The allegation involving Andrea Constant, from my understanding, is that she says that he, Mr. Cosby, had given her some pills, that she willingly took the pills. And, you know, and drink alcohol or whatever the case may be. And so I think this would have been an entirely different case had Mr. Cosby slipped something into her drink unknowingly. But that was not the case here, at least from what I understand from the testimony. So we never know what the jurors are thinking, but I would imagine that the average juror might think, all right, you're saying that he sexually assaulted you, but why did you take these pills knowingly? You know, I mean, and I think that's what I believe.
But is taking the pills, is not consent to have intercourse or other sexual contact.
No, it's not. It's not. But whenever you're looking at consent, you're looking at the facts and circumstances surrounding that consent. And so I think what the defense was saying was, you know, they were poking holes in the story, but I think they were also raising reasonable doubt as to that specific issue. Because you're always looking at facts and circumstances. No means no. We know that, right? And we know that you can't take advantage of somebody when they're intoxicated. But what leads up to that is important for the jury to know in terms of whether there was consent. Because theoretically, somebody could consent to sexual intercourse before that happened. They could. That could happen. I'm not saying that happened in Ms. Constant's case, but I think there were other issues at play, including that this incident happened in January 2004. Ms. Constant reported it a year after that, and so you have issues with delayed reporting. Now, there are lots of people that were arguing this is true, that sometimes people that are sexually assaulted report late, and that doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but it also doesn't mean that it did happen. And so you have lots of questions surrounding these allegations. Also, you know, Mr. Cosby did not testify, and I think that was something that was important, because I think he would have gotten torn to pieces on cross-examination. But also, there was no forensic evidence in this case. So with a lot of sexual assault cases, you have some type of forensic evidence, whether it's what we call a rape kit, a sexual assault kit, where somebody goes to the doctor and they have, you know, their body examined, and a nurse or a doctor comes in and testifies about that. You didn't have that here. So, I, you know, you've got a lot of different things at play, and I just think that there wasn't enough here. Would there have been enough if the judge had allowed in dozens and dozens of other accusers making similar allegations? Probably, but I think that would have been not protecting Mr. Cosby's right to a fair trial. And as much as everybody has a negative view of Mr. Cosby. And if he did what he did, it's certainly despicable, especially with regard to the dozens of women that have accused him. But that doesn't mean that he's not entitled to a fair trial. And you know, so this is the result we've got. But
okay, so this jury is from Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, which is Pittsburgh, which is way on the other side of the state. And if you know anything about Pennsylvania, you know it's Pittsburgh on the western part of the state, Pennsylvania on the eastern side, and Tennessee stuffed in the middle. Sorry, it's just a little Pennsylvania joke there. little rednecky in between the two cities. Anyway, but the truth is, you know, when it came to this trial, it didn't matter whether you were from the Philadelphia area or the Pittsburgh area. Everybody knew about Bill Cosby, right?
Right.
So it really didn't matter where the jurors came from.
Well,
now, it's one of the things in a retrial here. They're going to be trying to, both sides are going to be trying to figure out where the jurors are coming from. What happens here with the retrial? Do we get to find out who the jurors are and what they were thinking?
Generally speaking, it depends on the local rules of whatever jurisdiction you're dealing with. But generally speaking, judges will say to the jurors after the trial is over, if you want to talk about your deliberations or anything involving the case, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. It's totally up to you. So both sides, I'm very confident, will reach out to the jurors and try to speak with them about what was going on in the deliberation room and why they came to the verdict they went. But even perhaps more importantly, what was the vote total? Was it 11-1 for acquittal? Was it 11-1 for guilt? Or was it something closer than that? You know, and because you're required to have a unanimous verdict, if it was 11-1 for guilt, the prosecution, I think, is going to be much more likely to retry the case. I know they've already said that they're going to, but I think if it comes back, 7-5 or something closer, I think the prosecution will be much less likely to retry the case. But the other advantage, I guess you could say, to both sides is, and probably more to the defense side, because the defense didn't put on much of a case, is what's the strategy? We know what the prosecution and the defense's strategy is. And so, so that's something that's interesting as well. Is what is the strategy?
So what did you make of the Cosby defense team, A, putting up such a a short defense? And B, what do you make of them ripping the judge, ripping the prosecutor? I've never heard of that before. That just seems kind of silly when you're facing a mistrial.
Well, was that Mrs. Cosby? I heard her.
Yes, that was Mrs. Cosby. That was a family person reading a statement from Mrs. Cosby. But certainly the Cosby defense team could have stopped that if they'd wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a really unwise move. I mean, I don't understand the point of that other than to maybe try to put public pressure on the prosecutor not to retry, but I think that's just going to embolden the prosecutor.
Yeah, I was going to say,
When you have a mistrial, when you have a mistrial, I don't, especially in a mistrial, you don't say anything about the case. I mean, that's kind of the general rule. Now, to be fair, the prosecutor also made statements about the case, and something that troubles me about the prosecutor is he essentially ran for election based upon this case. I mean, this was the primary reason that he ran for election was because the old prosecutor wasn't going to try Mr. Cosby, and he was going to try Mr. Cosby. I don't know how it seems pretty wrong to me to base your election campaign on the fact that you're going to prosecute one individual person. But you're right, Mrs. Cosby should not have made statements. And I also had a problem with Mr. Cosby's, whatever his advocate was. I don't even think it was his lawyer. It was his spokesperson that was going out there after this mistrial, raising his fists in the air as if this was something to, go out and have some champagne over. This is a mistrial. It's not a not guilty verdict. And so I just think you're egging the other side on. It's not good optics. It's fine to be happy about something like this, but I don't think you go out, especially in a mistrial, and start celebrating.
Have you ever had the opportunity to watch a jury deliberate?
No. I mean, jury deliberations are secretive. nobody really can watch a jury deliberate, because we don't want to invade the province of the jury. That's what the general cases say on the issue. Now, there are certain very limited exceptions where we can pierce in to see what the jury has done, but those are very, very few and far between.
As a defense attorney, wouldn't you love if they masked the identity of the defendant and the victims in cases and maybe waited till many years later? Wouldn't you love to see how a jury deliberates?
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes, Sly, you can get that information when you call, if you contact jurors, if they are agreeable to talk to you after the trial. You know, and I've certainly done that. You can, you know, if jurors are willing to talk to you, you can talk to them. And you will find interesting tidbits about what a jury thinks. And oftentimes, it's very surprising. Oftentimes, it's not what you think they were thinking. You know, you might think, well, okay, I got a not guilty verdict. They must have agreed with this and this and this. And then you call them, and it's, you know, it might be some of that, but it might also be, well, you know, the video, there was no police squad video, and that was gone. It was missing. We thought that was strange, and that provided us with reasonable doubt, even though there's no requirement that squad video is recording in the particular situation. So it's things that you don't, you know, you might not think of. But jurors are told to use their common sense when they go back in the jury room to deliberate. And so you have lots of jury consultants that get paid a lot of money to do what they do. But in the end, it's very hard to predict what a jury's going to think.
Finally, are there other judges that would have let more of this evidence against Mr. Cosby from these other cases in? You know?
Yes, I think so. Yes. And that's the troubling thing about what we call other acts evidence. We're not supposed to let in evidence that shows that, well, because he was accused of this before or something similar, therefore he must have done it again. But you know, there are oftentimes judges that, in Wisconsin, for example, although you can't get into what we call character evidence, is generally inadmissible, if the evidence would go to someone's motive or their intent or their modus operandi, in other words, you know, this is what they do when they sexually assault somebody. They give them some type of drug, and then they take advantage of them sexually. Well, then that can arguably come in under what we call other acts evidence. And so judges have to apply certain standards, but Sly, as you know, the law is not perfect. And so from judge to judge, some judges might think that it's, might rule that it doesn't come in, while another judge under the exact same facts might rule that it does come in. I mean, judges are human, and this is why judges matter, and it's why judges are not just calling balls and strikes, as one famous Supreme Court justice once said.
And boy, he turned out to be an activist justice. Casey Hoff, criminal defense attorney, thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
You know, we work hard every day. In mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.